Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm Deidre Tyler, host of the New Books Network today. We're going to be talking with W. Jeff Barnes, author of Mingo, a novel. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks, Deidre. I hope you are.
Doing great. I wonder if you could begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the chance to speak with you today. I've been a trial lawyer for the last 35 years, and in a recent discussion I had with a group about Mingo, someone asked me whether my experience as a litigator had informed how I approached the book, and I really hadn't thought about it much up to that point, but in reflection, I think it probably did, because as a trial lawyer, we're trained to try to see the other side of the case that we're on in order to provide our own client a good representation. We need to understand where the other side's coming from. And so I tried to do that with this book and try to show both sides of many issues. And as one of the characters in Mingo said, no matter how thin a pancake may be, always remember it has two sides. And that's what I tried to do in Mingo. But in terms of this particular story and how I became interested in it, it's in part because of my father's connection to coal mining. He was born in Pocahontas, Virginia in 1919. Pocahontas is a small town on the West Virginia-Virginia border, and it was a coal boom town in the late 1800s. And his best friends were first-generation Americans of Italian and Hungarian descent whose parents had come to America, much like the Peduzzis in the novel, looking for a better life for themselves and their families. And I was fascinated that he had these friends growing up that whose parents spoke very little English. And it was so different than my upbringing in a community where we only spoke English. And then as he got older and in my early years in the 60s and 70s, he tried to make a living mining coal. He was what we called a truck miner, truck operator. And he and half dozen men every day would go in and mine coal seams that the large coal companies couldn't economically mine. And he'd come home every evening covered in coal dust. And the probably the biggest reward he got for all those years of crawling around in coal seams too low to stand were bilateral knee replacements. And then the biggest factor in me coming to this story was my childhood fascination with the Battle of Matewan, that took place on the main street of Matewan in May of 1920, a year after my father was born. And I was fascinated that a gun battle could erupt on a main street in a town in 1920s America involving dozens of pro-union coal miners and a handful of 10 or 11 Baldwin Felt security agents. So that's what drew me to the story. And I wanted to write a story that dealt with brothers who end up on opposite sides of that shootout and explore how they got there, what led them there, what conflicts they had to overcome, and then how did it resolve. So those are the things that led me to this particular story. And I guess in conclusion about this, I'll say, in doing the research for the story, I discovered just a wealth of compelling characters like Mother Jones and Sid Hatfield and Don Chafin, and events like the Bull Moose special attack on the Holly Grove tent camp and Sid Hatfield's execution and the Blair Mountain battle that I thought provided the bones for a great story. So that's how I ended up writing Mingo.
You begin the story with the funeral of Dirk Wood and Bossom's mother. Why was this central in telling the story?
Well, we never meet Ma, as you say. This book begins with her funeral, but throughout, her presence is felt, and it's clear that she was the glue that held their family together. She brought her boys up in a religious household and instilled in them a strong work ethic and an abiding love of family, and I think a sense of duty to others. And her death in 1908 was the catalyst the catalyst for the divergent experiences that the two brothers, Durwood and Bascom, had as they grew older, and which ultimately led them to be on opposite sides of this Matewan battle in 1920. And as she's dying, she had her husband, who is referred to as Pa in the book, promise to send Durwood to Richmond to live with her cousin Grace and Grace's husband Walker. Walker was a general counsel for a railroad in Richmond, and she knew that if she could get Durwood there, it would get him out of a life of working in the coal mines and provide opportunities that he wouldn't otherwise have. Meanwhile, though, that meant that Bascom, who was 14 years old at the time, was going to be left behind working in the mines with Pa.
Now, once Dirk Wood ended up in Virginia, tell us about his adjustments to the city life.
Well, when he didn't want to go, and his father told him it was just till things settled down, so he expected it was going to be just a quick trip to Richmond and back to Matewan, West Virginia. That, of course, that didn't turn out to be the case. But when he first arrived in Richmond, he had an encounter with a kid that we see throughout the early part of the book named John Randolph. And John Randolph made fun of Durwood because he was from West Virginia. And if you remember, in 1908, that wasn't that long since the Civil War had concluded. And the sting of that defeat was felt still pretty acutely by many people, including this young John Randolph. And so He teased Durwood for being a Yankee and a hillbilly Yankee at that. And he made fun of his name. He made fun of his shoes. And so it was kind of a rough beginning for Durwood. He had an experience on his first day in school where he was asked to show the other classmates where West Virginia was on the globe. And coming from the poor school that he came from, he had never even seen a globe. So he wasn't able to show the people where West Virginia was, because he didn't even know what the globe was, which of course elicited laughter from his classmates. So he had kind of a rocky start to his beginning there in Richmond, but he fortunately had folks there that helped him adjust. He had the abiding love of his mother's cousin, Grace, whom he eventually referred to as Aunt Grace. And he also had help from three other folks, Hattie, who was the African-American domestic worker in Grace and Walker's house. And she, of course, in 1908, Richmond was used to putting up with the racial slights that came with living in Richmond or in the South at the turn of the century. And she told him a very, very important lesson early on, which was never to be ashamed of who he was or where he came from. And then his best friend, Ben, who is a younger brother of his tormentor, John Randolph, was a kind, understanding kid who just all he saw in Durwood was another friend. He didn't see him as an outsider or West Virginian or a hillbilly or a Yank. He just saw him as another kid. And then, of course, there was Cap, who was a young boy about Durwood's age who grew up on the, quote, wrong side of the tracks. And he lived down near the coal yard where Durwood encountered him when Durwood went down to see where the coal trains were going, hoping that he might, seeing the coal, might bring him a little bit closer to his brother and father back in West Virginia. And Cap and his little ragamuffin friends befriended Durwood and helped make him, you know, feel more at home than he had otherwise, because they reminded him of the kids he knew back in West Virginia.
When Bossom arrived, he arrived as a freeloader. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he, so when he left, well, he has an unfortunate incident in the mine back in West Virginia in 1912, where his mentor and friend is killed in a roof collapse. And he decides that he's had it with the mines. He's going to leave West Virginia and the coal mines behind, and he's going to make a fresh start in Richmond. So he hops the freight train. Now, keep in mind, he had money. He had saved up money from working in the coal mines, and he had money to pay for a ticket, but he, of course, was frugal and wanted to save his money. So he hops a freight train, or hops a train. He's in a freight car, and he's sharing that car with a couple of rail riders, or hobos, as they were known. Nice gentlemen. They arrive at the train station in Richmond, or the freight yard in Richmond, and they tell him to wait until it gets dark and then sneak off the train. But unfortunately, the railroad police were searching the train, and they, lo and behold, they find Bascom. And in the process of him trying to escape, he gets knocked unconscious and learns that later on that they've stolen most of his, the railroad police have stolen most of his possessions. And what saved him was a letter that he had in his pocket from Miss Grace. And the police captain, of course, realized who Grace Walker was, and summoned, or Grace Hopkins was, and summoned her husband Walker to come down to the police station. And it was his connection to Walker, a prominent citizen, that led to the charges against him being dropped, and for him being released from custody. And I think this sent Bascom an important message, and one that I'm not sure he particularly cared for, which was, it's not really who you are, but who you know that that matters, at least in some circles. But before he left the police station, he got a little bit of satisfaction in taking the money that the railroad police gave back under the guise that they'd gone back to the car and searched it and found the money there, to bail out the other two rail riders and get them out. So he paid it forward.
Now, Bossom had some adjustment to the big city of Virginia. Tell us about that and his connection with his brother.
Yeah, he did. And he was older. He was 18 when he arrived in Richmond. He had spent about, by that time, he had been working in the coal mines for about 5 years. And he, of course, was much more aware of the inequities that he saw around him in Richmond and the differences between, life in Richmond versus life back in West Virginia. And, you know, he had trouble adjusting to some things. For example, this, it's not who you know or what, it's not who you are, but what you know that matters. One of the hurdles that he had to sort of overcome was the differences in the treatment of the races. Hattie, who I think I mentioned earlier, was a domestic in the Grayson Walker's house. When they first meet, he refers to her as ma'am, and she asks him to not do that. And he asked why, and she just said, it's not done here. And he didn't understand that. He said, well, where I come from, manners is manners. So he had to adjust to that. And she very kindly told him, look, I'll know you mean it, even if you're not saying it. And, there were other things he had to get used to in terms of, again, the racial prejudice of the time. He had an experience where he is at a celebration in 1912. It was a celebration in honor of Robert E. Lee. And it's when he meets the girl that becomes his girlfriend named Belle. And Belle and her mother have a tent set up where they have food for the people who are at the celebration. And Bascom sees a black gentleman struggling under some boxes of food, and he rushes to help the man. Belle's mother said, no, that's fine, he's got it. But Bascom goes ahead and does it. And the next day, Belle wants to know why he did that. And he said, well, you know, obviously the man was struggling, looked like he could use a hand. And she said, well, she pointed out the fact that he was African-American. And Bascom said, well, you know, I may have a lot of flaws, but poor vision isn't one of them. And explained to her that she said, well, you know, in Richmond, the first thing you see is race. And he said, well, down in the mines, what I've learned, I worked with, you know, African-Americans and whites and Italians and Hungarians and all sorts of people. And the only thing that matters is whether you can count on the man next to you. So, you know, he had some issues like that that he had to adjust to after he moved to Richmond. Even the class distinctions where he and Durwood are going to go to the Forest Hill Amusement Park, and he invites along the Cap and his buddies who, as I said, lived on the wrong side of the track, so to speak. And they told him they couldn't come, and he didn't understand why. And they said, because they don't let people like us in there. It's for the, you know, the wealthy people. So he struggled with those kinds of inequities as he saw them. You know, but again, he was settling into Richmond with a new job, with a girlfriend, and with his brother that he so dearly loved. So he was trying to get over those adjustment issues, and perhaps would have if things hadn't changed back home in West Virginia.
What made him move back?
Well, so in Christmas of, I believe, 1911, and I guess he had come to Richmond in 1911. I may have said 1912 earlier, but I believe it was 1911. And that Christmas, he learns of problems back home in West Virginia. It was the beginning of the first mine war. And he learns that his cousin Sesko and his family have been kicked out of their company-owned housing and were living in a tent camp that had been set up and was run by the union. It was a particularly cold winter. And when he learns about Sesko's family and their problems, he learns that Sesko's youngest child has died due to hunger or cold, or, you know, it didn't really matter to him, but because of these conditions that his child had died. And Bascom remembered what Sesko had said to Bascom at the following the mother, the funeral of Bascom and Durwood's mother, which was, in times of trouble, family comes together. And so he, I think due to the strong influence of his mother and her belief in taking care of others, service to others, he felt that he needed to go back and try and help Sesko and his family and make sure they got through that that brutal winter in West Virginia. And so despite how much he cared for Durwood and despite how much he by that time had cared for Belle, he felt like he had to do it. Belle tried to talk him out of it. And he, as he explained to her, she had told him earlier in their relationship that he was, what made him different from all the other boys she knew was that he was always looking to help people. And he told her that if he stayed in Richmond, knowing what he knew about what was going on back in West Virginia with these, his cousin and these striking coal miners, that, and he turned his back on them, that he'd lose respect for himself. And even if she didn't lose her respect of him, that he'd end up in the bottle like his father. And so he gave up his job, he gave up his girl, and at least temporarily, he thought his brother to go back and help his family.
Big businesses, unions, socialism. How did you deal with historical events at that time?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think there's been a failing of our educational system that so few people, and myself included, because I surely didn't know this, but knew about the Battle of Blair Mountain. It was the largest armed insurrection in U.S. history after the Civil War. And it began right at the end of August of 1921 and went on for 3 or 4 days into the beginning of September. And it was kicked off by the murder of Sid Hatfield. Sid Hatfield was the town police chief who was instrumental in the Battle of Matewan a year earlier. And he was, Sid Hatfield was a hero to the Union coal miners, pro-Union coal miners. And he was on his way to a trial in McDowell County and was basically executed as he walked up exterior steps to the courthouse. And so the miners felt like they were not making any progress. They weren't being heard by the governor and by the coal companies. And so they marched on towards Blair Mountain, and their goal was to go over the mountain to get into Logan County to liberate their brethren who were languishing there in the jails for their pro-Union activities, and then go on over the mountain into Mingo County and do the same thing. And 10,000 coal miners were on this march trying to get over the mountain, and arrayed on top of the mountain and dug in on top of the mountain were about 3,000 state police, the Baldwin-Felt security agents, various townspeople trying to prevent this from happening. So this is a very, I think, a very important event in American history. And it seemed through different lenses, but one of them is sort of a political lens. And it's sort of been billed as this was a struggle in this particular battle between socialism and capitalism. And perhaps for many it was. For example, what I've read about Mother Jones, who was sort of a patron saint to the coal miners at that time. She was a firebrand from Ireland. She was in her 80s. She was a socialist, and she was a committed socialist. Eugene Debs, who is certainly earlier in the a few presidential elections earlier, was a socialist candidate for president. He got 1 million votes in the 1912 election. And that same election, a town in West Virginia called Eskdale elected a solid socialist ticket. So I think some people saw this as a struggle between socialism and capitalism. And I think some of the coal miners in these remote parts of West Virginia felt like if they unionized, they allowed the union in, they would be at a competitive disadvantage because their coal mines were so remote and the cost of extracting coal and getting it to market cost so much. And so for some of them, they may have believed that socialism is at work. I think others saw it as a convenient boogeyman. But I will say that, the Bolsheviks had seized control of Russia in 1917. And by this time in 1921, they had made it known that they wanted to export communism throughout the Western world. There's, of course, a part of the book where Durwood is in Russia fighting with the American Expeditionary Force, and Ivan, the Russian interpreter who fought alongside him, made it clear that the British feared the Bolsheviks more than they did the Kaiser's German army during World War I. So again, some saw it as a political battle, but to me it seemed, that for the rank and file miners, the ones who were part of this 10,000 man march, that they didn't so much care whether the politicians were Republican, Democrat, or socialist. But what they were looking for was for fair wages, for an honest day's work, safe working conditions, and for them, for the rank and file, I don't think it was a political issue. I think it was strictly trying to make things better for themselves. And so for them, it wasn't about overthrowing capitalism. It was just more meat and potato issues.
Well, we're going to save the rest of the story to the readers because it is an excellent book. What message do you want the readers to come away with after reading this book?
I would say there are a couple of things. First, as I hope the readers of Mingo will want to learn more about the history of this important event in the American experience. I had a friend of a friend who read Mingo pre-publication, and she commented that had she encountered the mind wars in the context of a history book, her eyes would have glazed over. But in the context of historical fiction, she found it accessible and interesting, and in turn was led to read more about it in history books, in history accountings. So I guess the first thing I would say is, and I've heard this saying before, you know, if you want to learn history, read a history text. If you want to understand it, read historical fiction. And, you know, the point being that, again, I hope folks will take this, if they take away from Mingo an interest in learning more about this sort of melting pot experience in American history that impacted whites and blacks and immigrants and rich and poor and Republicans and Democrats and socialists, then that will be a good thing for me. I will have succeeded. And I guess the second thing is to always remember, as one of the characters said in the book, every pancake, no matter how thin it is, has two sides. And it's a lesson that I need to be reminded of nearly every day. And it's just as important today, 100 years after the coal mine wars in Mingo, because it seems we continue to struggle along these same fault lines of race and class and capital and labor that Bascom and Durwood encountered and dealt with in Mingo.
Well, what is the next project you're going to be working on?
Well, I'm still practicing law full time, so I haven't been able to devote as much time to writing or thinking about writing as I'd like, but I'm considering a prequel to Mingo that would examine the land grab in the coal fields and the initial disruption caused by the arrival of the coal companies and the railroads. It would delve into the backstory of Ma and Pa that only gets passing mention in Mingo, as well as the 1902 strike that led to the death of Pa's brother and his daughter, Durwood and Bascom's sister. But I'm also looking for material in a trove of letters from my father's side of the family. His mother was one of five sisters. They were, according to my mother, they were very outspoken and liberated for their time. My mother came from a more traditional family, and she was enthralled by these liberated women born in the 1800s who didn't conform to the conventions of their day. And so I have a lot of these letters were written amongst and between these sisters, one of whom was a dance member in a famous troupe in the early 1900s, and then ended up running a finishing school in New Zealand and was in the Blitzkrieg in London during World War II. Another sister was a public school teacher in New York City in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And my grandmother was trained as an artist and a nurse at Columbia University in New York. So I'm hoping I might find something in those letters that will lead me to another story that readers will want to read.
Well, thank you.
But whatever it is, I plan to keep writing.
Thank you so much for being on the show, and we enjoyed your book.
Deidre, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.